Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
Buckle up, sodomites, and welcome to the Sinister Sissies podcast, your guide to true crime, horror, and everything man-on-man and macabre. I'm Jared, your master of depravity, and I'm joined once again by the wonderful Paul Karp from The Guardian.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's always good to have Paul on. And Paul has recommended our topic for this week. It is on Christos Tsolkas's book, Dead Europe.
Yes, I made you read a novel just like we're in a book club.
Yeah, you made me read. Maybe
I'm the sadist after all.
Now, since it was Paul's recommendation, I'm going to leave it to him to introduce this book.
So first of all, starting with the author, Christos Tsolkas is a gay Greek Australian predominantly novelist, and he's famous for novels about Australian suburban life, particularly the migrant experience, such as The Slap and Barracuda. Gay fans will also likely be familiar with Loaded, his debut novel about a repressed gay Greek Australian youth in Melbourne, which was later adapted into movie Head On, starring Alex Dimitriadis.
I didn't like it.
Oh, you didn't like it?
No.
Why not?
We'll get into why. I think we'll get into why, because I think I have an issue with his style.
Which other novels have you read?
I've only seen the films and miniseries derived from his books. This was the first time reading him, but it affirmed a lot of my prejudices about Tsolkas.
Oh, dear. Well, this, I guess, is a reader recommendation because I set Dead Europe when I was reminded by a listener, Chris, that Tsolkas is a big fan of Salo, which we reviewed a few weeks ago, and he even wrote a play based on it. He also has a new novel out soon called Damascus, which I haven't read, but today we'll be casting a little further back to Dead Europe, which was published in 2005.
So I think we don't want to spoil the book right off the bat, so it might be worth just kind of giving a broad overview of what the book is about so that if people want to stop this podcast and go read the book and then come back, let's do that at the very start.
Okay. I'll start from the top and give a big warning before I get to any huge spoilers. So the protagonist, Isaac, is a gay Greek Australian photographer who travels to Europe on a pilgrimage of self-discovery when he's invited for an exhibition of his photographs in Greece. He discovers a gritty and sinister Europe, far from the gleaming marble and picture-perfect moments promised by postcards and Kentucky tours. Underage rent boys, materialism, sadism, pornography, and rape. The whole novel is stinking with the odours of semen, shit, piss, and blood. Through recollections of...
Oh, you're making it sound far more exciting than it is.
It's great. Continue. What are you talking
continue,
about?
Continue.
Through recollections of his childhood in Australia and his grandparents' life in a rural village of Greece during World War II, we learn Isaac's family is cursed. His grandparents, Lucia and Michali, were paid to harbour a Jewish boy from the Nazis, But when otherwise Baron Lucia falls pregnant to the boy, she urges Mikali to kill him, and the boy's demon then stalks Isaac's mother, Rebecca, into the new world, and Isaac as he travels through the old world of Athens, Prague, Paris, Amsterdam, Cambridge, and London.
The way, as I was like midway through reading this book, my immediate response to Paul was like, all the spooky shit is like metaphors and shit, isn't it? That's my...
And you said it as if it was a bad thing. Can you explain why that was the case?
Okay. So we're going to get into the review part of this. So if you want to read the book, go read the book first before we prejudice you with our very biased views on these things. Because I think I'm right in thinking, Paul, you really like this book, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I thought you would too, because, I mean, the first threshold for something getting on the show is it sinister enough? And I thought this would be sinister enough for you, was it?
No. And I'll try and explain why, because I don't think it's me just being like shitting on like an Australian author that I already have like a slight prejudice against. Mainly because like Christos Tsiolkos, and if we're mispronouncing that name, I apologize. How do I want to describe this? He is a darling of the Australian literature scene. I think that's fair to say, right?
Yeah, but probably for more recent novels that involve less sex with barely legal rent boys. Like, he's become a bit more mainstream and respectable, but I guess all of his novels would be categorized as literary fiction. So, yeah, he's got a good rep.
And you know, he is known for kind of that more intellectual exploration of, like, themes and heritage and culture and identity and all of those sorts of ideas. And so that automatically put me as a bit of a prejudice against him. And then
I have the perfect quote that absolutely jumped out at me from the novel after your complaint that there were too many themes and imagery that stood for things like, you know, moral lessons.
So yeah.
It comes from a section of the novel where Isaac is recollecting a lecture by his photography teacher who's discussing the ethics of art. And he says, for her, art could only be democratic. What about horror, we'd counter. She would flash images of Dachau and Vietnam on the overhead projector. Horror, without compassion, was exploitation, she argued. So I wanted to level that charge at you that if you don't like things that are sinister because the horrific imagery stands for something, are you just in favor of exploitation?
And I am definitely in favor of exploitation. Well, so it doesn't surprise me that Tsiolkos is a fan of Silo. I'm assuming he's a huge fan of like Henry Miller and William Burroughs and, you know, all these transgressive writers, but he's not a transgressive writer. Like, when I was reading this book, it struck me as someone's attempt at being transgressive and nihilistic, but not actually having the capacity to understand or appreciate darkness.
Can I just give the listeners, you know, some examples, but as a brief rebuttal to the claim that he's not a transgressive writer? I mean, in this novel, the protagonist fucks rent boys who are barely legal or probably underage.
I'm mostly underage.
He,
yeah.
Develops a vampiric bloodlust that is sated by drinking menstrual blood, drinking blood from bandages in waste paper baskets, licking the wounds of people that are, you know, beaten or abused that he meets along the way. So, I mean, the claim that it's not transgressive, a brief read of the many Amazon reviews of people that wussed out.
I want to talk about that because I was originally skeptical about this. The only reason they ended up agreeing to end up doing this on the show, because I was originally skeptical that it would be appropriate for Sinister Sissies. And then I looked on these Amazon reviews and it's things like, a book full of unlikable people doing unpleasant things to each other. 2 stars. I couldn't even make it halfway. It was unpleasantly sexually explicit and violent. 1 star. The gratuitous and woeful self-indulgent sex scenes were gross and off-putting. 2 stars. So I was like, cool. This is like actually going to be something that I'm into because it's alienating his core audience. But the book itself is this really poorly integrated blend of attempts at nihilism, this kind of magical realist stuff, and historical fiction. And the stuff that you were talking about earlier of what you see as like very clearly transgressive things seem really artificial to me. So there's things like heroin addicted parents, the like former neo-Nazi boyfriend, the teenage hustlers, the pedophilic sex parties, the like drinking of menstrual blood. Sure, in isolation, those things seem transgressive, but they're just so clumsy that it just, to me, came off as Tsokas being like, look at how edgy and dark I am. But it's like a sheltered boy's version of being a nihilist. It is not authentically nihilistic. He is not a Henry Miller. He is not a William Burroughs. He is not a Bret Easton Ellis. There is not an authentic love of nihilism there. And I made that comment about like lessons and stuff. It's because every time I was reading something that was meant to be really, really transgressive, implicit in the text was like Tsokas' voice being like, it really makes you think, doesn't it? Like that's the impression that I got from reading this book.
I don't know. You've read a bunch of reviews that didn't like the novel because it was gross. And I think that you don't like the novel because it has a message. I think they're both pretty kind of 2D approaches to it. In terms of it being artificial or clumsy or forced or whatever, I would appreciate some examples to substantiate that, because I find the descriptions of, for example, the sort of ritualistic rape in the club scene, the haunting image of the boy demon that comes back in his photographs that he takes on the trip as he gets them developed. I found those things quite compelling. So, I mean, I'd appreciate more detail about what you found clumsy or artificial about it.
Okay, well, what about the kind of shoot in, like little dark elements, like the parents being addicted to heroin, right? Did that seem like narratively convincing? Like, to me, that was like, ooh, let's just add this little edge in there, this little dark edge.
How do you actually transgress rather than just spray yourself with the allure of transgression? Because couldn't a viewer watch Salo and say, oh, and now they're you know, eating spoonfuls of shit, now they're just sawing their heads off, just going for, you know, the most sensational, you know, the most sensational aspect there? Like, what distinguishes those things in your mind?
I think in my mind, it's whether or not the person is actually putting themselves in a position of like dark fantasy, like actually giving way to dark fantasy. I will say there are points in the kind of pederast, pedophilic sexual scenes where I do get a hint that Tsokas is almost exploring, you know, dark desires that he might actually have, or at least giving his all in trying to actually describe those desires.
Well, but before we defame anyone, I mean, no, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt that Isaac is a protagonist, not just a cut and paste job of the author between the pages.
Sorry. I didn't mean it quite the way that it's
the pederasty out, and the pedo stuff is pretty realistic, yes.
Yeah, and there is descriptive components to it, and it feels a bit more authentic than the kind of a lot of the dialogue they have. So much of the book involves him traveling around Europe and having these dialogues with people that are, to varying levels, like quite anti-Semitic or like very flawed or all those sorts of things. T- to me, all of that dialogue is like artificially set up to create this feeling of like, look at how fucked up everyone is. And none of those people seemed real to me. Similarly, too, the major one is it's in Prague, I'm pretty sure, that he has this, he meets this porn person who, and they end up going to like an underage sex thing. That to me didn't seem realistic. It seemed completely artificial. It seemed like a really naive, sheltered person's version of like fucked up sex trafficking in Europe. It was too theatrically nihilistic in that if you're going to do nihilism, do it completely. Do it authentically. Well,
I have to bow to your superior experience of the East European fetish scene. But you liked the underage sex stuff. But it just sounds like you wish he.
Let's not use like. Like is a bad word for that.
You wish that Isaac met his boyfriend at a knitting club, you know, and he didn't have a neo-Nazi tattoo, and his dad was still alive, rather than having overdosed. By the sounds of it.
But, like, the reason I didn't like those things is that they didn't seem coherent in the full story. Tolkis was like, I'm going to write a William Burroughs-like tale or a Henry Miller-like tale. And so he was like, oh, well, we need some fucking of underage boys. We need some sort of drug stuff. We need some racism stuff. We need, like he was listing it all out in a way that to me didn't seem authentic, because I think to pull that off. So the reason like William Burroughs gets away with writing transgressive fiction is because he was a fucked up person, like a genuinely fucked up person. So when you're reading his stuff, you get the feeling of that bizarre outsider perspective.
All right, so I think you're welcome to disagree on, you know, whether you think it's convincing, but narratively, like, it does work very well for the themes in terms of, you know, the boyfriend has, like, a past where that he can never be reckoned, you know, he's never going to get rid of. That's represented by the tattoo. You know, the dad at first is quite a, you know, moral shining light who tries to teach Isaac not to be anti-Semitic, unlike his mother, but then, like, you know, his body and mind degrades, you know, and he, in his senility before his overdose, is, like, just as bad as anyone else. So, I mean, I can understand why, you know, you would dislike it if stylistically you don't think it was carried off well. But in terms of narrative and themes, I thought it's very cohesive.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is it though? Because I feel like most of the novel has, you know, they're trying to say this kind of lesson about, you know, Jewish identity and historical trauma and cultural heritage. Like, there's all of that up until the point where he either becomes a vampire or there's like a vampiric metaphor that comes into play. And from then on, it tries to be nihilistic, right? It tries to say, well, there's no point to anything. And I don't know if it concludes affirming any of those original themes either. Like, do you get what I mean? Like, I don't know if I'm making sense here, but like the three quarters of the novel seem to be trying to say something. And then the last quarter is like, eat shit and die, nothing matters.
I don't have as great a difficulty reconciling the themes that you're never free from your past and your roots, which, you know, would be the 2-second summary of it. I don't have difficulty reconciling that with the nihilistic conclusion that we're all kind of doomed. Because it's the old world is bound to reach into the new. You know, Europe is this kind of rotting carcass of a society, and the message seems to be that we can't escape that. So I don't think the themes that the past conditions the present is, you know, mutually exclusive with the theme that we're all doomed and the nihilistic conclusion. I think it actually is an argument to that conclusion.
I can get what you mean in terms of it's this idea that you were so determined by the past that trying to create your own meaning now is pointless.
Yeah,
is that the point? Is that the point?
Fatalistic, yeah.
Yeah, okay. In which case, okay.
It doesn't matter what he takes a photo of, the demon is always there. Like he takes a photo of something quite innocuous, like a sleeping man on the train, and then it's a horrific, you know, when it's developed, it's a horrifically disfigured, you know, shrieking, painful expression on everyone.
The kind of magical realist components of it, do you view them? So I thought originally, up until the last chapter, I thought that all of those kind of magical realist parts were metaphorical, like the idea of the curse, the idea of him being vampiric in the later half, like we're meant to view that as more of a transformation in himself type thing, but not like literally supernatural. But I'm pretty sure in the last chapter, don't they try and say that this is like a real thing, like that vampire component is like a real thing?
Look, it's just like it's like the ending of Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho. Everyone obsesses with whether or not it quote unquote is real, whether it's quote unquote a dream, you know, whether it really happened. And in both instances, there are indications of both simultaneously. There are times where you think, "Oh, this is impossible. Like he couldn't actually be offered to kill this fat drunk Russian within hours of meeting these people in a hotel room, you know, that would never happen," or "Oh, he couldn't actually have, you know, licked the blood up off the face of someone who'd just been hit, you know, in full view of her husband." Like there are, you know, times when you're like, "Oh no, it couldn't possibly be real," but then there are other times where you're reassured, no, as unlikely as it seems, that, you know, his mother and his boyfriend Colin are feeding him blood to keep him alive on the plane on the way home, you're supposed to think that it actually happened. I think it's both at the same time.
But it has major impacts as to how you view that main character, though, because on one narrative, and this is what I had throughout most of the book, on the one narrative, he is this like self-indulgent artist who goes to Europe seeking out like poverty porn and like as in he's wanting to revel in the darkness of everything.
Well, a lot of it happens incidentally, like the whole Prague adventure is you know, when he meets up with a friend of his from photography school who, despite being quite talented, has had to sell out and become a pornographer or to work for a pornographer. And a lot of it he does just going with the flow. I don't know how much he seeks it out in every instance.
What about meeting the former lecturer, I'm assuming, who's again, this is another thing where I think it's just Chalker's just throwing in edge, where it's like he sees like this former lecturer, this heterosexual lecturer, who, like, tack it on, is a former sex offender. Like, I don't know. So that's what I mean. If you take it as not supernatural, he is this little, you know, self-indulgent artist tourist traveling around trying to breathe in Europe, and then just gets more and more goth as he goes through, and then ends up kind of having a psychotic break. And I have no compassion for him if that's the case. Or there is this metaphysical allure that's driving him to be there, that is controlling him, that is transforming him, and he's becoming this thing because of this historical heritage. To me, the two narratives matter a lot to whether or not I find this character, who is clearly an insert of the author, this character interesting.
I think it's if I had to pick between those two, it's the latter. But I don't think that the question of whether or not he literally drinks blood, or whether he just feels a lust for violence and bodily fluids metaphorically, I don't think that answers that question.
One of the things that I was reading when I was looking at other reviews of this book is Robert Mann, who is this wanky Australian intellectual, he actually accuses the book of being anti-Semitic, which I thought was an interesting... I think it plays with the stereotypes of the Jewish people.
Yeah, I think the characters are anti-Semitic. I don't think the novel is anti-Semitic. Like, the characters are constantly, referencing, things that we use to slur Jewish people, like blood libel and Christ killers. I don't think the novel is not saying that they're endearing when they say those things. They are grotesque when they scapegoat Jews or are envious of them or hateful. So I don't really agree the novel is anti-Semitic.
I agree. I mean, if anything, that's the kind of that's the part where Tsiolkos is actually quite restrained in that, like, He could do a version of the narrative where it's very, very clear that all of those, like, the main character could be like, no, you're completely wrong because X, Y, and Z, but then there is a component where the character almost seems not convinced, but enticed by some of those anti-Semitic ideas at various points in the novel.
He gets upset when he's told not to take photographs in a Holocaust museum. Mm. He has the run-in with the guy in Venice who shows him through the ghetto and is happy for him to take photos of historical evidence of anti-Semitism in Venice. But then when he Isaac reveals that he's not Jewish, his guide through the ghetto loses his shit at him. So perhaps that is what Robert Mann's referring to.
But I mean, that's character. I will actually give, like, Tsiolkos, like, that having a flawed character is fine. I don't think that is necessarily saying anything about the message of the book. Not that I hate that idea of having an ethical message in a story generally. You know that, like, I think that you can be enticed by a narrative without the narrative having to teach you a lesson on something.
That's the one thing we haven't spoken about yet, which was our conversation that we had offline where I may have offended you slightly. Well, no, you just seem to dislike narratives where there's some connection being drawn between past and present, because you seem to have a view of, like, structure and agency that is that agents can, you know, perfectly crash through structures like geography and ethnicity and class and things and be totally free of the past. Like,
that is a mischaracterization. Clearly, where
it's not that far off.
Clearly, we're influenced by our families, and obviously our families influenced by their families, and there's a connection there. I think what I dislike, and it's mainly because this is how I view a lot of literature at the moment and a lot of writing at the moment, is there is a very modern phenomena at the moment of people trying to derive meaning in their current lives by looking back. And I think the point of disagreement there is that you think that, like, everyone has always done that, is your view.
Yes, I think that's what the history of fiction and recorded history would indicate, is that people have always tried to understand the past, understand the present.
And I disagree with that. I think that that quest for meaning by looking to heritage and culture is actually a new phenomena, because only now do we have this feeling of disconnect between where we came from and now. And mainly I'm just sick of books exploring that idea. This idea that we need to derive meaning from our heritage.
Well, that's generally pretty central to all literature about the migrant experience. So yeah, I guess you dislike all.
Oh, don't you?
Well, no, seriously. Like, you want migrants to like get off a boat and then be like, oh well, that old country, that sure was something. Now we're in the new country, drawing a clear, bright line under it, and let's not try and, you know, go back to the motherland and understand anything about, you know, our geography and place and ethnicity.
I think that's unfair. I think it's not that I'm, because that's making me sound like I'm not interested in hearing about migrant family voices, and I am interested in hearing that. But
what stories of the migrant experience would you allow then, if you don't allow a comparison between the old and new world, and how previous experience conditions present experience?
I'm not like a funder of literary grants. I'm not allowing or not allowing anything. I think there are meaningful things to be said about growing up in a different sort of family to like a regular Caucasian Anglo family. I think that there's something really, really interesting to be said there. I think it gets a bit different when writers source their heritage for content. I've yet to read anything interesting that has come from that. Mainly because I don't think if you have grown up in Australia and you come from a migrant family that you necessarily have the best understanding of your country of origin.
That's the point. It's that once you move from the old country to the new country, you then have this cultural memory of the old country that's preserved, but it itself is fictionalized. It's a place that no longer exists in that way anymore, and that's why that you'll see this stuck out to me when I was traveling in Greece, and it comes up constantly in Dead Europe in the early chapters. Is he's always talking about how
Paul has Greek background, by the way. I don't think we've mentioned that.
He's always talking about how there's bouzouki music, like the traditional, like, you know, string instrument playing, and techno playing. They're always like clashing with each other in a city square somewhere. Mm. So the traditional view of Greece and modern Greece are always clashing. And, you know, you say that you don't find anything interesting that comes out of that, but I mean, that is some of the most interesting stuff in this novel, is like the political dimension, which is the confrontation between in the new world, in Australia, there's a confrontation between cosmopolitan migrant culture. So you've got like Isaac's dad, who studied in France, and his first lover is an Italian bloke called Bruno Palavecchio, and they introduce him to high culture. And then there's a contrast that's drawn between them and the like ignorant, racist Australians in the community that they've migrated to. And I don't think that you could make those comparisons, if you didn't think that their culture and class was conditioning the way that they experience the new world.
Maybe this ultimately does come down to so I have a good example of this. My ex-boyfriend was of an Italian background, and And he always used to talk about the fact that he would, because he was a teacher, he used to teach in schools, and he would describe this difference between, like, kids who came from migrant backgrounds and what he called Weet-Bix kids, which were these very, like, Australian, divorced from any kind of migrant background, very Australiana-type kids. Maybe my Weet-Bix kid prejudice means that I can't actually derive pleasure or understanding or joy from a novel that does explore those questions of heritage.
It's disappointing to hear that you're missing out on that, because you know, as a Greek Australian, I can enjoy migrant stories and Weet-Bix kid stories. So
I'm just like, I don't know if that's necessarily the case. Maybe I need to read more. It's just I cannot connect with those sorts of stories personally.
Disclosure, you also don't think that sexual identity is that, I mean, is that formative, yeah, as well. So it's we should mention that, you know, Jared is not just beating up on migrant narratives. He just, like, really does it, like, a collective class and identity basis for personal identity just doesn't feature very prominently in your worldview at all.
No, and you can look bad at me for that, I suppose, but I can't
I'm trying to dig you out of a hole by saying that you're not singling out the migrant experience as being not worthy, because you actually don't think that, you know, you actually think that you know, queer experience should be just about sex rather than marginalization, for example. Like, you don't like a collective identity based on that either.
Well, so, and I think that is the, like, that is the true nihilist position, isn't it? That all of these things are actually fictions. That these stories that we tell ourselves to give ourselves meaning in life are fictions that are baseless. And that kind of is my position. Talking about sexual identity, though, I was expecting more of that in this book, but it doesn't quite go there.
Why don't you think it goes there?
As in, there's no, I don't know. I think that homosexuality as a topic, to me, didn't feature that much in the narrative. I mean, he fucked a lot of people, but it wasn't. Did he fuck women as well? Am I correct in thinking that?
Yeah, he does, but it's particularly after the point that he's taken a liking to blood that he eats out a woman on the train to Berlin. Is, I think, the first sex act with a woman.
Yeah, so sex seems kind of incidental, he sleeps with a guy that's a straight guy. He sleeps with guys that are getting married to women. Like, as in, sexuality, I thought, was kind of treated a bit interestingly in this, and that he didn't try and create a theme.
I think he definitely did. I mean, he talks about his first lover and his first love both being Italians who were older than him, and explaining how like his relationships with them.
Wait a minute, we say older than him, but like it was a abusive relationship.
Well, one was 13 and 60, and the other was that was the gap, and the other was like 16 and 42 or something. So there's that. There's the conversation that he has with his dad, where his dad discovers that he's gay. Also, it's referred to constantly in his travels, like the on the ferry, the sailors make some comment about, you know, him being 36 and only artists and gypsies, you know, travel on ferries alone at that age. So I think it clearly is part of his outsider perspective.
He seems quite untroubled by it, though. Like, as in, I didn't see his sexuality as being a, as opposed to his identity of being Australian in traveling through Europe. That was like a point of conflict.
Yeah, well, he's you know, he's out and proud. He's not troubled about it. He's not closeted.
Mm. So I think if you were going to recommend this novel, I think that this is a very good book which divides Paul and I in many ways, right? Like, as in, if the discussion and narrative you find yourself siding with Paul, you will probably like this book. If you are amazing and nihilistic and, you know, DM me, if you agree with my themes and ideas, then you're probably not going to like this book. I think that is the best guideline.
If you believe in the past and that we don't exist instant to instant as a different person separated from all culture, class, geography, ethnicity, and context of every kind.
That is not...
If you believe in the past, then I think you'll appreciate this novel.
Thank you to Paul for joining me. If you are a fan of the show and you use Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and give us a written review on Apple Podcasts. The current ratings are great, but you'll see that there are two interesting recent written reviews, so I think it's probably good to get some balance on there. As always, you can follow the show on Twitter and Facebook at Sinister Sissies, or you can follow me at Jared Bartle. That's Jared with a Y. Until next time, stay sinister.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.